Hello, and welcome to the Christian Worldview. My name is Matthew J. Coombs. I am the Vice President of the Institute of Biblical Defense. With me is Dr. Phil Fernandez, President of the Institute of Biblical Defense and Pastor of Trinity Bible Fellowship. Doc, it's been a while.
It's been way too long.
Well, I mean, we see each other a lot. We just haven't done our
this program
for a while. We're both very busy.
You were just a little guy last time.
I was. And we have a guest today. You want to introduce our guest?
Yeah, it's Don Davison. And Don, I think you have earned, what, three one-year certificates through the Institute of Biblical Defense. So there's probably nothing I'm going to say tonight, or Matt's going to say tonight, that's going to shock Don. So Don's pretty much in the know on Christian apologetics, and you help lead the praise and worship at the church you attend, but then you also teach an adult Sunday school class, and you've been teaching apologetics and cults and stuff like that. So Matt and I will be discussing an issue, and Don, you know, feel free to contribute or ask questions or make comments, and you're one of the IBD family. So
you too, if you are once you hear Don talk and you get excited, feel free to apply to be a student for the IBD as well. We offer unaccredited degrees in apologetics.
Actually, yeah, we have 1 year certificates, but you can get three or four of them, and there's a Columbia Evangelical Seminary actually accepts our credit.
Oh, that really?
Wasn't our goal. We wanted to keep, you know, $60 per course, and a course is probably equivalent to a 4-credit-hour course. And so, you know, it takes a lot of money to move towards accreditation, things of that sort. So we never really even thought that schools would want to take some of the credits. But we've actually had some people, like, for instance, Don with his 3 1-year certificates, if he transferred over to Columbia, he'd be a year away from a Bachelor of Theology degree and stuff.
That's nice. Well, even the students that I've taken, you know, there were people in their early 20s, and I trained them in a lot of stuff that I've learned. I told them, I was like, listen, you know, you guys are more versed in apologetics than people that I...
Yeah.
Graduated Bible school with.
Well, I've mentored students and on a doctoral level, and then did some teaching at a few seminaries, a little adjunct teaching, and you know I've taught pastors apologetics that, you know, pastor churches of 500 people in Texas, and they've got a Master of Divinity degree from Southern Baptist Seminary, and they're like shocked. They say, well, I've had one, you know, I had one of them who was doing it through extension and was listening to lectures, which was college level lectures for the Institute. That's what we do, college level lectures. And he called me up, and with his Texas twang, he said, now what grade were these students? And I said, well, you're looking at freshmen and sophomores of the college level is the equivalent. Mm-hmm. And there was a silence at the end of the other side of the phone. He said, brother, he named the Southern Baptist Seminary, one of the leading Southern Baptist seminaries, and he said, I had an apologetics course when I worked on my Master of Divinity degree, and he said, I had to stop, you know, he was downloading it from, or uploading it from, whatever you call it, from the internet, from our website. He said I had to keep stopping it because it was so hard to follow. The information was so advanced. And I said, well, a lot of these students have been with me for a few years.
You know what you're
thinking. And but the fact of the matter is that, you know, Talbot, where you got your master's degree, Liberty with Gary Habermas, we got your undergraduate, Southern Evangelical Seminary. You take those three, maybe Trinity Evangelical Divinity School out of the mix, you take those schools out of the mix, and there's hardly anybody who's really spending any decent amount of time teaching Christian apologetics.
Well, I mean, even when I was working on the master's, I found I had to say, okay, listen, I can't listen to any more of these apologetic classes right now because I need to focus on my classwork. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, I got so I used as much information from your lectures on my papers as I did from, you know, books and stuff that I was reading. I mean, even look at, like, Drew McCullough, student of yours from Crosspoint Academy, studied with you for years, goes over to Liberty University, great Bible program, and he goes there, and he was disappointed because it wasn't, you know, as in-depth as yours. And
I was just teaching him on the high school level, so as a junior and a senior, our discussions were, sometimes they get to, like, seminary-level discussions. Now, I don't test them on a seminary level. I test them on a high school level, and I don't demand 20-page papers. But at least we discussed the issues to the point where he went to Liberty. He was totally disappointed, but I kind of wish he hung in there until he got... They wouldn't let him take any Mark Forman's courses.
Oh.
Dr. Mark Forman...
He's a good philosopher.
He's a brilliant guy, far more brilliant than me, and he would have definitely challenged Drew, but they wouldn't allow him to take his courses till the third year. And Drew was on his first or second year, and he just said...
And it's kind of the thing is, too, is with the undergrad, you got to kind of jump through the hoops.
Yeah.
You know, at least with us, you can come to us, and, you know, I've got some students that I want to focus on, you know, biblical theology. Other ones, I want to focus on apologetics. With us, you know, we can focus your degree or whatever you want to study and kind of mold it around you.
Yeah, and it's now, Drew, I told him, too, I said, look, Drew, and, you know, if money's a factor, things like that, because Biola was a little out of his price range, about two or three times as much as Liberty. But I told him, just go to University of Washington and work on a four-year degree in philosophy. I said, it's not going to be, like, real advanced, but it will be challenging because all your professors disagree with you because you're a Christian.
Yeah.
And so, I think that'll keep them, you know, fairly challenged. Mm-hmm. And
I was looking at the, who was it there? They have a great epistemologist at UW. I forget who it was.
I haven't really kept up with it.
I think it was Feldman? I don't know. Anyways.
We used to have two or three world-class philosophers teaching somewhere in Washington State, like Western Washington. And
they had a great epistemology program, and I was like, hey, maybe, you know, I'll do like I do my PhD work there in epistemology. And I was looking over their courses in philosophy, and I was so disappointed. It was like ethics of global warming, what?
I have to say this, and it's really sad, but what is going to kill philosophy in non-Christian schools and on the graduate level, on the undergraduate level, is political correctness. I have a Lutheran student. His father's the assistant to the bishop. His mother's a pastor. And he's a brilliant theologian himself. And he's only 18. And great writer, great thinker. And he wanted, from sitting under my classes, he wanted to study theology. But one of the Lutheran colleges he was thinking of going into is not real conservative. And he looked at the theology courses, and it would be like, you know, feminism, you know, gay theology, you know. Liberation. So liberation theology. You're going to come out of that, know a whole lot about political correctness and how to shout at people, but you're not going to be a good philosophical thinker. Yeah. And so what he did was he went to a more conservative school, which doesn't have... as much, but they are putting together a Bachelor of Arts in Theology and Apologetics, and so he's excited about that. But I did tell him, I said, if you don't go to a very conservative Christian college, philosophy doesn't mean the same thing it used to anymore, and now it's all about political correctness. And I mean, you go to Princeton, and their thinkers are like Peter Singer, founder of the modern animal rights movement, and Cornel West.
Didn't Singer say like a full-grown pig is worth more than a...
Yeah, the life of a full-grown pig or chimpanzee is worth more than a newborn human baby because they have a higher level of consciousness, and that's how he defines... Was that?
Does he have children?
I know he has a mom with Alzheimer's that he cares for. See, now you can... Like, I invest my worth... Like, if you have a bad day and you go out and you shoot a dog, I can forgive you. But if you tell me that that's my dog, It's different. Now I'm really ticked off because I've invested that dog. I've adopted the dog. My dog is part of my family. And that's the way, you know, we have infinite worth because God's vested in us His infinite worth. He created us in His image. And so human life is worthy. Well, if you don't believe in God, then it's like, okay, well, then how do we find any worth in human life? And so it's not a metaphysical thing. It's a more of a performative thing. What can you do? What is your level of consciousness? Mm-hmm. And so he's decided that a certain level, you need to attain a certain level of consciousness. Now, having said that, if a baby is born and it's all deformed, physically and whatever way, if the parents want the baby and are willing to sacrifice for that baby, they can invest their value into that baby, just like God vests His value in us, His infinite worth in us. But so that's the way he sees his mom, that his mom doesn't fit the master race definition, and he won't use the phrase master race, but every other page in his practical ethics. I'm exaggerating there, but it seems like every other page, he says it so many times, he has to draw distinctions between what he's saying and what the Nazis said. And it's like, you know, I ask my students at Cross Point Academy, what would you say to me if every other day I had to tell you, now keep in mind, what I'm saying is different from what the Nazis are saying. They said, well, we would start to get the impression that maybe your views are so close to the Nazis that you have to remind us that it's not the same thing. And I said, bingo, that's exactly the way it is with Peter Singer of Princeton. But that's what's going to kill philosophy and an awful lot of higher education. In fact, I'd argue political correctness is going to kill all education that suffers from that disease. You know, I mean, look at it today. When you get a Christian is a creationist, whether you like it or not, usually that Christian creationist, if they're going to step out and say that and admit that and then dialogue on it, they probably have lots and lots of reasons why they're creationists.
Yeah.
They can present lots and lots of evidence. Now, evolutionists might not consider it good evidence, but the average evolutionist, when they find out I'm a creationist, they said, you're a creationist? I thought you were a knowledgeable guy. I said, well, why do you believe in evolution? And what's the number one response I hear? Well, duh, all the world's leading scientists are evolutionists. Well, and it's just kind of like they got their own infallible quote.
Creationism has become a derogatory term.
Yeah.
You know, like, oh, he's just a creationist.
Yeah.
And if that's not the informal fallacy of poisoning the well, I don't know what is.
Yeah.
You know, you're saying, I can't even hear your evidence, because we're not even on the same epistemological plane, and I can't even begin to hear it.
You talked about poisoning the well. That's what political correctness will move philosophical argumentation, will take philosophy from argumentation, rational argumentation, and take it into the arena of, at its best, propaganda, at its worst, shouting.
You can't have rational argumentation anymore.
It all
gets personal, and people get offended.
And it's like the point that if you do believe something that's not politically incorrect, they say, well, how could you believe that? But when they ask it, they're not really looking for an answer. They're saying there's no way you can believe. I mean, what is it that J.P. Moreland had said? You know, it's like when reason is abandoned, all that remains is shouting.
Yeah. And see, these are people, postmodern culture, where absolute truth is rejected. They didn't use reason to arrive at their beliefs, at their conclusions. They used their emotions, their will, their desires. So when it comes to defending those beliefs, they're not going to refer back to reason. They didn't appeal to reason to get where they were at. So immediately you're going to get an emotional response. I remember with the Clinton administration, every time somebody agreed with one of their policies, there was nothing but a personal attack in return. And a lot of people might have thought, oh, wow, the Clintons are mean people. Well, I don't think that's necessarily the case. They're postmodern people. And from the, you know, postmodern, if you want to see how postmodernists argue their position, look at a postmodern community, whether they're gay activists or radical women's lib activists and pro-abortion activists, and look how they conduct themselves at their rallies, and the hatred, the screaming, the yelling, you know, all the stuff you hear about the Tea Party. And the Tea Party is a mixed bag of goods. There's some good, true, freedom-loving
people.
It
started out with the right intent, and it got hijacked.
Got hijacked by neoconservative, big government Republicans, but who are just as much part of the establishment as Democrat leaders. But look how they've been maligned in the press. But when you watch their rallies, there are a lot of, you know, peaceful people just protesting in a peaceful way. But you see what's going on in Wisconsin over there, and that's there you see the politically correct and the way they do it. And political correctness is one of the children born by postmodernism. So, and it just basically said, look, this is our political view. There's no argument. The debate is over. If you don't agree with us, you're politically incorrect, you're a bigot, and the name calling begins. And so the unfortunate thing is that philosophy departments are either moving in that direction or they're already there. So even at Ivy League schools now, it's hard to learn how to think and how to argue and present evidence for your views when you're just taught to name call anybody who disagrees with you, and you just act like, well, I'm in the know, I'm a graduate
and
of
then,
Ivy League
or
school.
It's just the sense that, too, they'll use very non-rational arguments. They'll just say, well, you know, I believe in science, or I believe in this, or, and it's just, and I, you know, I find myself so often when I get in these discussions, I say, do you realize it doesn't really mean anything?
Yeah, yeah.
When you say, I believe in science,
I believe in science,
or,
not religion, false dichotomy.
Yeah, oh, it's a false dilemma right there, and it doesn't mean anything.
Yeah.
It's like, and, you know, I've talked to people, and they're like, well, you know, I'm rational. And I was like, okay, that doesn't mean anything.
Yeah.
You know, you can't just say on that and not posit any evidence.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, rationality is based on the amount of and strength of evidence.
Yeah.
It's
and
not
then,
evidence in and of itself.
And then it's, I think the presuppositional, the great presuppositional apologist, Cornelius Van Til, I think his transcendental argument was right on that particular point. I think he was wrong to make it the only argument in defense of Christianity.
Because, yeah, he argued only the transcendental argument was, that was the only way you could...
So he's incorrect on that, but Van Til was anybody who tries to reason against, well, I'm a rational person, I'm a reasonable person, Van Til would say, but there's no basis for the validity of your reasoning powers unless you got them from a rational cause, unless you got them from God. And so in other words, just the validity of just us trusting our reason, our reasoning abilities, presupposes the existence of a rational God. Now, Van Til would say it presupposes the existence of a rational triune God. I would disagree. It doesn't take a triune presupposition, although I do hold to the Trinity, obviously, but I argue to the Trinity, not from the Trinity.
And I don't see how anyone could say that the Trinity isn't a necessary attribute of God. But you see, when you study the scriptures, it obviously is the case.
Yeah, I would say not a logically necessary, at least with our level of thinking of human thought. I don't, you know, I would agree with Aquinas that, you know, there are certain truths about God that we can learn through reason and discover through reason. But there's some we can only accept on faith because God revealed it supernaturally to us through the scriptures. And so God's existence is something you can prove through reason alone. But the fact that God is triune, that's something that we accept by faith in the revelation of the scriptures. Now, Aquinas wouldn't deny the fact that there's good evidence that the Bible is God's word. But it still takes us trusting in that. And you had mentioned, too, that you wanted to talk about history.
Yeah.
And so and that was, I was going to do a little segue here. Philosophy teaches us there's different ways to learn. There's reason, you know, rationalism. There's empiricism, things we can learn through the five senses. There's pragmatism. Sometimes we learn by figuring out what works.
Things are true by definition.
Yeah, and things that are true by definition and would be more in the rational category. So there's different ways to learn, but faith. We use the term faith so much for religious faith that people like Richard Dawkins, who is not a philosophical giant, he's brilliant in scientific areas, but he's not
a great biologist.
Not really good when it comes to reasoning. He thinks that science is totally of reason and religion is totally of faith, but people don't understand the entire faith means you trust in an authority, and that may be a good authority, like when you drive your 2,000-pound car over a cement slab called a bridge suspended hundreds of feet above a waterway, you're exercising a tremendous amount of faith in an authority, in man's technology, man's ability to build bridges that support that kind of weight. And that's what history is all about, faith. Because if the eyewitnesses, even when an eyewitness reports something to you, you have to have faith in the authority of that eyewitness and the reliability of that eyewitness. But if the eyewitnesses are dead, then you have to have faith in the reports left behind. So history is faith and authority, and what it comes down to is that authority reliable or not? And when it comes to the first century data on the life and death and resurrection of the Lord Jesus Christ, we have good reasons to have faith in that authority, yet the Robert Prices, the Bart Ehrmans, the Elaine Pagels want us to accept all kinds of bogus reinterpretations and reject the good authoritative historical data, and that's just not doing history properly.
I have a couple responses. One of the things you mentioned, that was Stephen Jay Gould's thesis, and he was a scientist, and he claimed that faith and science were completely separate, non-contradicting realms.
Non-overlapping
realms, yeah. I forgot what the other one I was going to say was. I should have interrupted you. No, I'm joking.
Oh, no. I was pretty much done myself, but it just, what I'm saying is...
I know what I was going to say. One of the things you always said is, you know, when people say that science and faith contradict each other, but at the same time, if you look at even something like the scientific model, you have argued that you need, in a sense, faith. And we're using faith in the sense of you're trusting a reliable source.
Yeah.
In a sense, if you're a scientist, you utilize, you know, the scientific method and produce results. Well, if I'm going to reproduce those results, I have to, in a sense, have to have faith or trust that you didn't falsify your data, or that you came to this conclusion, and I can compare it with this conclusion.
Yeah.
You know, and another thing too is, you know, I was talking to an atheist the other day, and in a sense, I think I'm equivocating a little bit on how you define faith, but you know, one of the things I argued was, I said, listen, I do not have faith that the resurrection occurred. It's not something I believe because I, in a sense, don't have a reason for it. My faith on the resurrection, or my belief in the resurrection, has to do with historical reliability. Because of this events, the archaeological evidence, the creedal evidence, all these things, I'm justified in this belief. And so then he obviously asked, well, where does faith come in? I'm like, well, faith comes in is where you can apply the promise of the resurrection to yourself. And I said, you know, Jesus said, when I've been raised up, I will draw all men to myself. I'm like, that's where faith comes in, is the fact that you're saying, can I apply that promise to myself? Can I be declared righteous by faith?
Yeah.
What do you think about that?
Well, I think it not in a bad way, but there is a little bit of equivocation there. Now, I like the way Aquinas differentiated between belief in and belief that.
Oh, okay, I got you.
So weak evidence can bring us to the point where we say, yeah, I believe that Jesus rose from the dead, but now am I going to believe in him as the risen Savior and enter into a personal trust relationship with him? And what Dawkins is doing is only using faith in the latter way,
yeah,
and failing to realize that science cannot even prove that there's a physical world existing outside of our mind. That's a philosophical issue. He cannot prove that the five senses, that we gain any kind of knowledge of the world through the five senses. Those are all things that are assumed and accepted by faith. And I like the way Aquinas does that, where he differentiates between belief in and belief that. My main point, though, that I was making earlier is that when you get these people that raise the bar so much so that it's, you know, it's pretty much, I'm not going to accept that Jesus rose from the dead unless I saw him die and I saw him rise. I'm sorry, Bart, you're 2,000 years too late. I'm sorry, Robert Price, you're 2,000 years too late. I mean, when I debated Robert Price on an internet radio show, Reggie Finley's show, I asked him, I said, are you a Holocaust denier? Because he was expecting only, he would only accept stuff from eyewitnesses. And he said, no, because my father liberated one of the camps in World War II. And so my follow-up question was going to be, so then after your father dies, are you going to give up that belief? Or after you die, should your son give up that belief? But, of course, Reggie kept interrupting me and giving me questions that were nowhere on the level that Robert Price did, or where I would have liked to have dialogued with him. So, but basically, these guys are—it's like they're turning history. They're almost acting like history is science in a laboratory, where if I don't have Jesus' body under the microscope, and I don't see the resurrection through binoculars, it didn't occur. That's not the way you do history. You trust in authority, and so you trust in eyewitnesses or people who knew eyewitnesses, and you try to figure out if these are credible eyewitnesses. And we have all the first century data that proclaims Jesus has risen, no first century data arguing against that. And then we find out that these first century witnesses were suffering and dying for that testimony. This is reliable. This is about as reliable as you're going to get in the context of history.
Well, one of the things you mentioned here is, you know, you said earlier, you can't prove through the sciences that there is an external world beyond the senses, or beyond their self. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about this idea of proof. Mm-hmm. Because we say proof all the time. Can you prove that? Can you prove this? If Ernest Henson asked you, could you prove the resurrection? I think you'd say yes, but I think you'd need to qualify that.
Yeah.
So explain to me. Yeah. Explain to me when you say, if I were to say, can you prove 2 + 2 = 4, and can you prove that the resurrection occurred? How would you respond to that?
Yeah, I use the word prove in the real world, in a much different sense than I would use it in a philosophy class.
Okay.
Philosophy class, you've got to define what exactly you mean by proof. And if you're meaning that you're proving something with logical necessity, that's outside the realm of history.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, logical necessity is even outside the realm of science. You're dealing with induction, with science arguing from the particulars to the universals. So by definition, you're not using deductive reasoning that's going to bring certain conclusions. And so the whole idea of logical necessity escapes not only history, but science as well. And so what you have to do is you have to say, well, what is the discipline we're talking about, and what would be good evidence? And so I'm using the word proof more in the way the common man would use it, providing a strong case for something. But whenever you try to provide a strong case for something, you have to do it in the context of the discipline that you're discussing. And so when it's history, there's certain evidence like ancient manuscripts and other writings that might support those manuscripts, maybe archaeological evidence, whatever it may be. when it's scientific evidence, it's going to be of a different type. And when it's philosophical evidence, you know, depending if you're talking about reason, like 2 + 2 = 4, once you define what 2 means and you define what 4 means and you define what plus means and what equal means, it has to equal 4. It's logically inescapable. But that's not the way we're saying that we could provide evidence for Christ's resurrection.
So let's take something like Thomas Jefferson writing the Declaration of Independence. Could you prove that with logical necessity?
No.
So what then must we use in order to prove something like Thomas Jefferson wrote the Declaration of Independence?
Yeah, there we would basically go back to the writings of the day by people like Jefferson, whether it's his personal letters, even going back to earlier history books, that these guys did the research and looked into it. But going back 250, 260 years, you've got a lot of evidence. So a guy would be almost a total ignoramus to reject. You'd have to ignore so much historical evidence to see that Thomas Jefferson, to deny that Thomas Jefferson wrote the Declaration of Independence. But that's the same kind of evidence that you would look for to establish the crucifixion and the resurrection of our Lord Jesus, except when you're going back 2,000 years instead of 250 years, it's going to be a lot tougher to find that kind of evidence. At the same time, we're overwhelmed with all this evidence. And here's an interesting thing. Most historians, even non-believers, will acknowledge that Jesus of Nazareth's death by crucifixion is one of the most firmly established historical events of ancient history. Yet the fact of the matter is, I don't think there's much more evidence for his crucifixion than there is for his resurrection. The main difference between the two is one involves a miracle, the other doesn't. Mm-hmm. So,
you know, that's one thing, too, I often come across is people say, well, I cannot hold to the historical reliability of the New Testament or these events because they invoke supernatural events. And, you know, my argument to them is, well, you know, there is no reason to, because it invokes supernatural events, there's no reason to automatically deny them. And they're like, well, I hold to, you know, the sciences again. And I said, well, listen, even if the sciences, even if the natural sciences are prescriptive or descriptive, mm-hmm. it doesn't matter because neither of them would preclude the existence of miracles. No. So, for example, if you said, okay, I hold to the natural sciences and I think that they're prescriptive, in a sense, they only prescribe what events can occur. But by saying that, then you're saying that you know exactly what will occur in the future. You say these things can only happen. Basically, you're saying is there's going to be no more scientific discovery.
Yeah.
And then if you say if they're descriptive, well, the problem with that is then you say that you know everything that they're ever
prescriptive.
So whether you say that natural sciences are prescriptive or descriptive in nature, neither of them would preclude the existence of miracles.
Yeah, and the thing is too is there's a sleight of hand going on because you're talking about history. And then the person says, well, I won't reject the historical accuracy of the New Testament documents because of my philosophical bias against miracles. And so basically, they've switched the subject. They've left the branch of what's good historical evidence, and they've inserted a philosophical view. Now, in philosophical circles, the bias against miracles is not on a sturdy foundation. A lot of what you said there about prescriptive or descriptive laws, the fact of the matter is the only way that you can really rule out the possibility of miracles is if you could rule out the possibility of the existence of a personal, all-powerful God. And believe me, that's a lot harder to do than a lot of people think. I mean, if you listed the 100 of the greatest philosophers in the history of philosophy, I can almost guarantee that 85 to 90% of them believed in the existence of some type of God. Even David Hume and Benedict Spinoza, two guys who are credited with the strongest arguments against miracles, Spinoza believed in a pantheistic God, and David Hume believed in a deistic God, but they still believed in some type of God. Once you acknowledge the existence of God, I think it's only a short step from there. I think deism is one of the weakest worldviews out there. And, you know, the Richard Dawkins, they love Hume, but Hume, being an empiricist, acknowledged that our five senses do not tell us that the law of causality is real. And science is all about trying to find causes for effects, and that's why Dawkins is an evolutionist and not a creationist. He disagrees with us on what the ultimate causal power is there. But if he's a strict empiricist, if he's going to go strictly by what his senses tell him, he should be a skeptic like David Hume and acknowledge that if all we're going to go on is the senses, then who knows what happened.
Let me ask you this question. What if you came across an ancient document that, for the most part, seemed reliable, but then mentioned something like a flying pink elephant? Mm-hmm. Now, some would say that, well, by our holding to miracles and saying you can't deny it just because it's miracles, what would keep us from denying this text and be like, well, there can't be pink elephants or something like that?
Yep.
How would you respond to that?
I would say they're really talking, it's like Dawkins' flying spaghetti monster.
Yeah.
They're really talking apples and oranges. Now, I might not be able to point out exactly why that's the case. I'm going to try to suggest a few reasons. But like with the flying spaghetti monster, Richard Dawkins has made $0 refuting the existence of the flying spaghetti monster and debating believers, adherents of the flying spaghetti monster religion on college campuses. He has made thousands upon thousands of dollars, and even probably in the millions of dollars when you count his book sales, mm-hmm. arguing against the existence of God. So basically what I'm saying is they're not the say, well, this is a really good analogy for that. No, it isn't. Yeah. It stinks. I'm sorry, Richard Dawkins, your analogy stinks. And I would say the same for the pink elephant. I think there's a lot of people, and I'm not an evidentialist to the point where I don't believe you have to have a lot of good evidence before you're justified in believing something. I think you have to have some evidence, but I think if people just pick up the Bible and read through it and then say, you know what, that sounds reasonable to me, and it sounds like these guys are reporting history, and it makes a lot of sense. The basic, as I read through the Bible, the picture it paints of reality looks a lot like reality. And when I hear atheists talk, the picture they paint of reality doesn't look anything like reality. So I don't even think that a person has to turn to the wealth of historical evidence that is there. But I think a lot of people would just read the gospel accounts, and then they'd read an account about a pink elephant, and immediately something would tell them, this sounds really fishy.
You know,
and you keep in mind, you look at the miracle claims of other religions and how bogus they sound, and then you read the life of Jesus, and it says, you think, you know, if he's the same guy that taught this other thing earlier on, I really think he could pull that off. I really think he could give sight
to the blind. And also, all the other, the miracles attributed to Buddha, they don't occur for some time until after his death. With Jesus, you have
hundreds of years
within
later.
The first generation. You know, and I have two responses as well. One of the things is I was talking, giving an argument for the historical evidence for the resurrection, and a guy said to me, was like, well, how do you know that it wasn't, you know, aliens that caused, like, you know, the resurrection? And I was like, well, simply, we don't have any evidence for that. And I am more of a strict evidentialist, I think, than you are. And I always, you know, I always tell my apologetic students, you know, evidence, evidence, evidence. It comes down to evidence. And so I said, you know, why should we believe that? You know, philosophy is not based off of what if, like some people like to think. I'm like, philosophy is based on since that. Mm-hmm. Since this is the case, since that is the case, since we have this evidence. And then my other thing, too, for against the flying spaghetti monster is, you know, someone said to me, it was like, well, why, think of the reasons why you deny the existence of Zeus and Odin and all these other gods, and then you'll understand why I deny the existence of your god. And I was like, well, the reason why I deny the existence of all these other gods, like the flying spaghetti monster and Odin and stuff, is there is simply no evidence for him. And he's like, well, you have no evidence. And I was like, absolutely I do. Yeah. I have ontological, teleological, axiological, cosmological arguments from necessity. We were talking about the arguments, or before we gone, or, no, we mentioned a little bit here, but the very fact that reason exists is an argument for the existence of God. Yeah, we have historical evidence. We have something personal evidence. Yeah, yeah. All these things. I don't know anybody who's going to give you an argument for the existence of Zeus because of a personal experience that they've had. But we have all these areas of evidence that will point to that.
Yeah, and Zeus doesn't even, his resume just does not, he's not qualified to be the infinite ground of all the finite things that exist, but there has to be an infinite ground of all the finite things that exist. So even if somebody believed in the false god Zeus, you'd still have to acknowledge something like the existence of the God of the Bible to ground his existence and everything else. So I think, there's overwhelming evidence. And the point on evidentialism, what I'm basically saying is that the amount of evidence that most evidentialists claim you have to have before believing something, 99% of what they believe when they go through their life isn't based on that kind of evidence.
True.
And so all I'm talking about is I'm all for my old professor Gary Habermas and a good friend of ours who all those guys have met him before and spent some time with him. But I'm all for him providing evidence for the Christian faith, but I just don't think we should push evidentialism to the point where we're acting like the elderly lady in the church who believes something because she read it in the Bible.
Yeah.
That in itself is good reason to believe something. It's the most respected book in the history of mankind.
I don't think Habermas is epistemological evidentialist, though.
When he argues for evidentialism as a methodology... The thing is, too, is here we're talking about intramural debates between what is generally called classical apologists. So I fit somewhere as a more of a cumulative case apologist, but even there, I would say I'm more of a cumulative case for pragmatic reasons. It seems to...
what I said to him in class. I like evidentialism as an apologetic methodology, but I was like, but for pragmatic reasons, I find that my witnessing of someone is so much more effectual when I start with the existence of God.
But I think if you're going for a very high degree of probability, I would side with Geisler and the Thomist and the classical apologist that if you're not talking about dealing with a particular person, an individual, that the worldview issue should be settled first. Because if you settle the worldview issue, does God exist? And if God exists, what kind of God is it? Oh, it's the God of theism. Then you can move on from there and say, well, that kind of God can perform miracles. Mm-hmm. Now let's look at the historical evidence to see which theistic religion is true. And so I do think that the logically speaking, the God issue... precedes the issue of did Jesus rise from the dead. Now, I'm not saying that it's wrong if somebody argues for the resurrection first. You got to start somewhere.
Yeah.
But what I'm saying is, if you're going for logical system, you got things like does absolute truth exist? Can man know truth? Does God exist? Is it possible for are miracles possible? And then did Jesus rise from the dead? But these are, like I said, these are intramural debates among friends.
Yeah.
And I sometimes I think too much gets made out of it.
It's not a bad, at least it's not like the apologetic methodology wars like between Cornelius Van Til and Gordon.
And that's what Steve Cowan is a brilliant guy, but his book that he edited, that Habermas, Craig, Feinberg contributed to, he acts like Frame represents Van Tillian presuppositionalism, and then it's implied that Gordon Clark is mentioned in the preface of the book as if because Clark was a presuppositionalist and Van Til is a presuppositionalist, they agree with each other. Well, Frame has the best refutation of the transcendental argument of Van Til in print, yet Van Til said it's the only positive argument you could use for God. So Frame is not a true Van Tillian presuppositionalist. And if you question him and listen closely to his answers, Frame will admit that. So he's the wrong guy to represent Van Til. That's number one. And number two, to imply that Clark was the same kind of... it's a totally... There's a bigger gap. There's a bigger gap between... A bigger tension between Vantillian presuppositionalism and Gordon Clark's presuppositionalism than there is between any of the debates within classical or traditional apologetics.
And only that, too, you know, he argues that Alvin Plantinga is a presuppositionalist as well.
Yeah, and that really doesn't... God is a basic belief. Actually, it's what it is Phidism light. Where it's... basically, he's saying that you can believe... in God, you could be justified in believing in God with no evidence whatsoever. I always think there's got to be some evidence, even if it's a small, still voice in your heart, or you just look at a beautiful sunset. There's got to be some evidence. But he believes that you can believe in God without, and you're justified in it with no evidence at all. At the same time, you can find clues in nature, and he can argue any of the traditional arguments for God's existence as well as or better than anybody else, and sometimes he feels like doing it, but his main point is you don't have to. So it's kind of like belief in God by faith alone with no evidence whatsoever, you're justified. However, if you do want to try to help people to believe, and if you see clues of God, that's fine too. So it's kind of a Phidism light where it's kind of faith alone, but doesn't have to stop there.
Yeah.
But that's different than willfully presupposing something, saying, I am going to presuppose this, and then from that argue from God, not to God, and you can't argue in the other direction. That's a totally different thing than planning as a basic belief. I'm writing a work now that I don't know when it'll be done.
The apologetic methodology one?
Yeah. And so I might actually publish two different books on it. And but we'll see. We'll see where it goes. But
all right. Well, let's bring this back. We had it was funny in our last class. Dr. Habermas said he's like there's two types of.
And by the way, Matt's working on his PhD in apologetics and theology at Liberty University, so he flies out there for a few weeks at a time and takes courses, and then he has to come back and type up 35-page papers and read thousands upon thousands of pages worth of books. So that's what he's talking about, is one of the last course
he took on him. He said there's two types of rabbit trails. There's rabbit trails and there's sanctified rabbit trails.
Yeah.
And I think that was a sanctified rabbit trail, you know. We go off and start talking about apologetic methodology, but it's very edifying. So I think Dr. Habermas would have approved of our little rabbit trail.
Hopefully so. And when the professor talks about Raider football or McDonald's, then maybe it's not sanctified.
No.
So.
And that's funny. I work with a youth group, and first couple weeks I was working with this with my small group. We love to go on like these little rabbit trails, and I was like, dude, we're going to name our group Sanctified Rabbit Trails. And every time we go off in these little conversations, I'm really like, guys, this is not a Sanctified Rabbit Trail. So that's the name of our group now, is Sanctified Rabbit
Trails. That's good.
Let's get back real quick. I have a question. So, you mentioned before, we have, some of the original manuscripts and stuff from like Thomas Jefferson type stuff. We do not have first...
autographs.
Yeah, we don't have the autographs. We have manuscripts.
The New Testament and the
Exactly.
Old Testament.
So, how detrimental is not having the actual documents?
Everybody would love to have the originals, but the fact of the matter is, at this point in history, not having the original documents for first century writings is a non-factor. Because we don't have the originals of anything.
Yeah.
So all we have, that's what textual criticism is trying to arrive at what the originals actually said by studying the copies. And with the New Testament, 26,000 handwritten copies, 5,000 in the original Greek. You've got all the quotations of the scriptures from the church fathers just a few hundred years after the apostles died. just from the church fathers alone, you could reproduce the entire New Testament with the exception of 11 verses.
And we do, and we did a series, Bart Ehrman's Main Objections to Christianity. I suggest you find those in sermon audio because you go into great detail on how this is the case.
Yeah.
So, you know, some people, they look and they think, oh, dude, a 30-year gap between, you know, how do we even know that Jesus ever existed?
Yeah.
What would you respond to that?
Well, a 30-year gap would be like a fragment, like John Ryland's fragment of John chapter 18, but you got about a 100-year gap from when the New Testament was supposedly completed and until you have, like, from the Chester Beatty papyri, just about the entire New Testament. You probably have 90% of it. And we have manuscripts that old. And that's, like, unheard of in ancient literature. Second place is Homer's Iliad, where you got about a 500-year gap.
And about and, 50 copies.
Well, with Homer's Iliad, yeah, at one time you had 643 copies. Now I think it's closer to 800 copies. But that second place, the 26,000 of the New Testament, Plato's writings, you only have seven copies, 1,200 years after the originals were supposedly written. So,
and
that's great. That's
third place.
Yeah, that's great. Plato's writings is pretty. It's not third place, but it's up there. It's pretty good.
Let me see this.
Pretty good evidence. But basically, what I was going to get at though is, forget about that gap there. New Testament scholars agree. I mean, even Marcus Borg of the Jesus Seminar. You have to be like a radical Robert Price who's on an island all by himself to reject this. But even Gerd Ludemann from Germany, who denies the resurrection, Marcus Borg, who at least denies a physical resurrection, these leading New Testament scholars are about as far left as you can get and still be respected by other New Testament scholars. And they acknowledge that, like, the Creed of 1 Corinthians 15, 3-8, dates, Gerd Ludemann puts it, within a year. He thinks that Paul got it and received it in Damascus when he got converted. So he puts the formation of that creed about the post-resurrection appearances of Jesus all the way back to within 1 year of Jesus' crucifixion. So really, when you get into the textual criticism, has become such a precise science now that we can argue you don't even need fragments. We can do internal study of the scriptures and find creeds or hymns or sermons that are so primitive in their theology and that are basically Aramaic, when the church was primarily Hebrew-speaking, which predate Paul's writings. I mean, virtually all New Testament scholars, Marcus Borg included, will give you seven of Paul's writings as authentic. And then you've got these. So Paul starts writing about 49 A.D. with Galatians or 1 Thessalonians, two of the accepted books. But he's already telling you, and in 1 Corinthians, mid-50s A.D., but he's telling you, I'm preaching to you, in 1 Corinthians 15, the same gospel message that the apostles preached. And all the way from the beginning, he says that he met with them 3 years after the crucifixion. So, in Galatians chapter 1 and Galatians 2, he met with them again another 11 to 14 years later. But whatever the case, what I'm saying is that the vast majority of the world's leading New Testament scholars will acknowledge we're dealing with early 30s A.D. evidence that predates even Paul. And they still, if they don't want to accept the resurrection, they'll try to come up with ways out of it. But the fact of the matter is, we're dealing with evidence that goes almost back to the events themselves.
And too, you look, you talked about like primitive theology. I mean, even look at Acts.
Yeah.
You know, like the theology in there is so, it's
the sermons.
Yeah, they're so basic, and you don't see anything of the mention of the destruction of the temple.
Yeah.
You know, so you those are two evidences right there that would lead you to earlier dating. Now, let me ask you this. I'll say one other thing. You know, like guys like, you know, John Dominic Crossan, mm-hmm. Price, Bart Ehrman, you know, it seems like their views are going to die with them. For the most part, you know, you don't see a lot of critical scholars really even holding to them.
I would say that, like, I asked that to Gary Habermas about Crossan, and he said I only found two, and he studied 1,500 of the world's leading New Testament scholars, and he only found two that backed him. And he doesn't even think that the other two are going to continue to hold to Crossan's view that Jesus wasn't placed in a tomb. His body was thrown in a common grave with criminals and eaten by wild beasts. And so I said, so when Crossan dies, his view is going to die with him. He said, yes. Now keep in mind the context of that is what we're talking about is within New Testament scholarship. The sad thing about what Bart Ehrman is doing and Robert Price, yes, they are New Testament scholars, but they're kind of doing an internet pop thing. They're writing pop books. I'm not questioning their scholarship, but what I'm saying is these guys are getting the message out to people who could care less about what New Testament scholars think. So basically what I'm saying is that Robert Price resurrecting the F.C. Bauer, Jesus is a legend, borrowed from pagan myths theory of 1870, that's not really making a comeback in scholarly circles.
No.
At the same time, I think after Robert Price is dead, we live in such a dumbed-down culture, we don't even know history anymore.
Yeah.
I mean, we have a lot of people who believe Dan Brown, and the guys, the names we mentioned, every one of these guys would laugh at Dan Brown, but we have people today who think, even sometimes educated people, if it's outside their field, that think Jesus was never considered God until Emperor Constantine in the Council of Nicaea, 315 A.D., and the evidence, Larry Hurtado, University of Edinburgh, effectively argues that Jesus was, the church, early church engaged in Binitarian worship and worshiped the Son alongside the Father as early as the early 30s A.D. In fact, he says, that's what defines Christianity as Christianity. And then he says that the Apostle Paul believed in the deity of Christ and taught it when he started writing 49 A.D., and he never argues for it. And Paul will argue for anything he thinks his readers might doubt. And if he's not arguing for it, it's because I'm writing to Christians, and all Christians know that Jesus is God.
Let me ask you this. Do you know any scholars, historical scholars, that deny like the existence of Alexander the Great?
No, I don't know of any. And you know, pretty much, I mean, you can pick up a World Book Encyclopedia about Jesus. His existence is not called into question at all. The only historian that questioned it and argued against it was G.A. Wells. And then Michael Martin, a philosophy professor, started to promote that view. And then the Jeffrey J. Louders and then Robert Price, people like Robert Price, kind of stumbled on it, and the Richard Carrier. So basically the Prometheus books crowd, the internet infidel crowd. And now some of these guys are scholars, but I suspect, you know, no one knows a man's heart, but I suspect that what we have here is the phenomena that is going on is that you have guys who decide, I don't want to believe that Jesus existed, and now I'm going to work on my Ph.D., in New Testament studies, so that I'll have some clout. In other words, I don't think it was scholarly research that caused them to come to the conclusion. They had the conclusion before they went.
Well, and you, Michael Martin won't take a debate on that, though.
No, he'll in his. I don't think he'll take a debate on anything at this point. But I don't. He's getting up in years though too. But he. He's a great guy, too. I debated him over the internet in 97, but then I got to meet him when I debated Jeffrey J. Louder at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. But basically the way he puts it in his work, The Case Against Christianity, is he acknowledges that he doesn't believe Jesus even existed, but he knows that most people will not accept that. So he said, for purposes of argumentation, let's just say that he did exist, and then he tries to take on Gary Habermas's arguments for the resurrection and things of that sort. But what that tells me is, here's a guy that is saying, in certain contexts I could see that. Like when I debate for God's existence on a college campus, and I don't want to debate evolution, I don't want to debate the age of the earth, I just want to debate does God or does God not exist.
Gotcha.
And at the same time, I do suspect, because, you know, as far as I'm concerned, get a guy to accept God's existence, lead a guy to Christ, and then you can argue about how old the world is and whether or not God used evolution, and of course I'm a creationist, but I suspect that Michael Martin knew that it was just too much of an uphill battle. And he would have to try to argue for something that all historians, disagree with.
The reason why I mentioned the Alexander the Great thing is, how long is the gap between when Alexander the Great existed and we have his first writings about him?
First writings about, I think the first recognized reliable writings about Alexander the Great, I believe it's like several hundred years. It could be longer, but I believe it's several hundred years. But an example, Geisler and Turek, and I don't have enough faith to be an atheist, there's a good example that I do recall. You compare Jesus with just the carpenter from Nazareth, right? Mm-hmm. Compare him with the Roman emperor of his day, Tiberius, and within 150 years of their death, there's only 10 different authors that refer to Emperor Tiberius of extant writings that are still in existence to this day.
One of those is the New Testament.
Luke, yeah. But in Jesus' case, you have 42 different authors. Now, granted, a big chunk of those are Christian authors, whether they're authors of the New Testament scriptures or church fathers, but you also have secular authors like Thallus and Pliny the Younger and Suetonius and Emperor Hadrian, Emperor Trajan. Why 42 different authors mentioning Jesus within 150 years of his life? And then, the atheists like Robert Price will say, well, that's not that much. You'd expect more. Why? He's 4.2 times as many times as the emperor. The guy was ruling the world back then.
Yeah,
so it just seems to me like that begs an explanation, and I think the best explanation is the New Testament account.
Well, if you have, like Alexander the Great, whether or not you doubt his existence, the proximity in time, if the events of him were written 100 years after, you wonder how accurate was the account. Mm-hmm. With Jesus, we have the accounts being written while there were still eyewitnesses alive to verify or deny that those things were really true.
And that's an extremely important point. Another issue is with the Robert Price thinks he could just throw out all the New Testament writings because they were biased. Well, who else is going to write about Jesus but his followers?
Yeah.
Yes, we're fortunate that others did too, but the fact of the matter is the most likely people to write about it are going to be people with a vested interest in it. But the fact of the matter is most of what we know of the ancient Roman emperors comes from people who are either paid by the Roman emperor to write, record their histories.
So do we?
Deny what Socrates?
Yeah.
Deny the existence of Socrates just because we learned from Plato and from most of the information we got about the horrible treatment of Holocaust survivors comes from Holocaust survivors.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't say, well, they were biased, let's throw that out. You know, that just doesn't follow. I could tell Robert Price, why should I accept your father's testimony just because he liberated a concentration camp after World War II? He was biased. He was fighting for the Allies. So, I mean, you know, if I use an argument like that, people would say, well, obviously you're trying to do revisionist history and you're some Nazi lover or whatever, but that's the kind of thing Robert Price is saying. And
that was actually one of the things that I brought up in class and asked Dr. Habermas about, because this is something I deal with a lot, is I said, you know, a lot of people say that the non-Christian historical accounts aren't there, or they're, you know, late or biased and stuff. And he said, you know, that, and this number has actually increased since his book was published, but he mentioned that there were 18 non-Christian historical sources that occurred within an early enough time that they could be credible sources.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he's like, if that is insufficient for somebody, it's like, I don't know what sufficient is.
Yeah, and see, with Robert Price, and I got to nail this down in my dialogue with him. I don't. It's hard to call it a debate because it really wasn't equal time. I might have spoken as much on the program. It was less about 2 hours as he did, but a lot of that was being interrupted by Reggie Finley and answering his questions. And his question, Reggie, God bless him, but he's not on the level that Robert Price is. So I really wish I got to deal with Robert Price's issues rather than explaining to Reggie Finley the difference between the resurrection and the ascension. He was confusing the two. And I was telling them they're 40 days apart and stuff like that. What Robert Price will do is he'll say that all the secular guys that say it, like Josephus, he'll even question that Josephus mentioned him, but everybody accepts the James passage, and James is the brother of Jesus called Christ, according to Josephus. So he must have mentioned that Jesus already, since he mentioned so many other Jesuses. But whatever the case, he just tosses these things out and says, well, they got their information from the Christian writings. So the Christian writings were biased. We can throw them out. These guys got it from the Christian writings, so we can throw them out. You get to the Apostolic Fathers. I threw that at him. I said, well, here you get from 95 to 156 AD. They would know better than you what the apostle said. And he said, they didn't. I don't believe they lived during that time. I said, everybody in the world believes that they lived during that time. What are you talking about? And he said, Irenaeus was lying when he said how far they went back. They were really contemporaries of Irenaeus. So it's like he pushes it to 180 A.D. and acts like Irenaeus is this big, huge conspiracy. And even the liberal Jesus seminar is part of this conspiracy, according to Robert Price. But Irenaeus was involved with this ancient conspiracy in 180 A.D., and it's like, dude, if you do history like that, you can just, you know, it's like Norman Geisler said in one of his debates, it's like telling somebody, well, you present hundreds of witnesses, and then they say, well, apart from all your witnesses, apart from all your evidence, you don't have a case. Of course, apart from my evidence, I don't have a case, because my evidence is my case. And so you can't just dismiss evidence like that. Especially when it's historical evidence. This is the best you're going to get, the first century evidence that we have. I mean, there's nothing in the first century where you can not only find these ancient copies so close to when these events occurred, but then also be able to figure out through internal evidence, wow, this particular creed here attributing deity to Christ or pronouncing his resurrection from the dead goes back to within a few years of his crucifixion. You know, there's nothing else but the death and resurrection of the Lord Jesus Christ that you can find that kind of evidence for.
You know, I was having lunch with a friend of mine, and he was very interested in apologetics. A lot of the times, you know, the church he grew up in, he was kind of shunned for asking difficult questions. And he loved it that I was answering all of his questions and stuff. And one of the things that came up is like, you know, what is the most difficult subjects for you to handle? And I said, honestly, the most difficult thing for me to handle, or the most difficult thing for me to discuss, is trying to get people to realize how good certain evidences are. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, no, this is good evidence. If you examine this, it's not really, you know, hard to necessarily prove that of God's existence or the stuff about the resurrection. It's about people not realizing, wow, that is solid evidence. The textual criticism is a great way to understand the reliability of the New Testament. So
yeah, we live in an information, I would not call it an intellectual age, I'd call it the information age, and we're suffering from information overload, so that we're being bombarded with so much information that the average person, especially the average American, doesn't have the time or the training to differentiate between bogus information and good, solid information that's based on the evidence. So, I mean, when a Robert Price or a Richard Dawkins or somebody says, oh, believing in God is like believing in the flying spaghetti monster, or that's just like the old ancient pagan myths, what traditionally was so easy for us to tell the difference between the two, now all of a sudden it's difficult. Those kind sometimes it's just the tone of the person and the way they say it. That just those the apostles were just pre-scientific. That's why they believed in. It's like, look, they had to know enough about science to know that dead bodies are supposed to stay dead. So when they saw Jesus' dead body alive again, they thought, okay, now it's time to worship this guy. They wouldn't have worshipped him if they were so gullible they believed resurrections happen all the time. So, but whatever the case, just to say, well, they were pre-scientific, the debate's over in the minds of so many Americans, because it's like we live in a postmodern, politically correct day where if you've controlled the media and you control the propaganda and you just bring forth that arrogant tone and talk down on the Christian... debate's over. If you get a room of 20 people and 20 people laugh at the Christian, the 21st person is probably going to join them and laugh at them. That's what we're facing. And another thing I find is I think this is part of your frustration there that you just mentioned. I get people ask, well, if God exists, why is there all this evil and human suffering? Well, then I have to embark on a 20-minute answer, which is abridged. I mean, you can write volumes on that. And what I find is the guy that usually asks the question doesn't have the attention span to even follow the 20-minute abridged answer.
And that's why I say, like, people that ask that question, they're not really saying it because they say, how does God allow suffering? It's, God cannot allow suffering. Yeah. It seems like Aldous Huxley was correct. You had those two famous dystopian novels, 1984 and Brave New World. And in 1984, Orwell argued that the masses will be controlled through limited information. Whereas Aldous took the exact opposite approach. He says, no, they're not going to be controlled with limited information. They're going to be given so much information that they're not even going to realize when something significant has occurred. And that seems to be the case.
That's a brilliant distinction between the two, because that's exactly what we're just being bombarded with so much information. It's like one philosopher once said that the debate used to be that we used to have to argue that God exists and Jesus rose from the dead. Now, in the 21st century, we're going to have to argue only one God exists and only Jesus rose from the dead. And in other words, it's just like we're bombarded not only so much information, but so much information about gods that it's like, well, yeah, if Jesus is your God, that's fine, but I've got something over here. And there's no meta-narrative. There's no way to judge between our different narratives. And so I'll believe what I want, you believe what you want. But if you tell me that I need to believe what you believe in order to go to heaven, then you're intolerant, you're a bigot, and there's no place for you at the New World Order table.
You point out too that that's actually the antithesis for intolerance.
Yeah.
Like I love your example when you say, if you walk in a room and you see two guys yelling at each other, and one's a Christian, one's a Muslim, and the Christian says, if you don't accept Jesus, you're going to hell, and the Muslim says, you don't submit to Allah, you're going to hell. We should look at that and smile and say, wow, we live in a very tolerant country.
Yeah, still have freedom of religion and all.
Yeah.
And instead, we're programmed to think those two guys are intolerant. And even Fox News compared the late Jerry Falwell and also the head of the Southern Baptist Convention of that time has compared them to Osama bin Laden, because they said that they believed salvation was only through Jesus. They said, Sean Hannity said, well, don't you realize you sound just like Osama bin Laden? And Bill O'Reilly also said it. And the thing is, look, Osama bin Laden is not a bad guy because he believes that the only way to get to heaven is through the Muslim God Allah. That's false, but he's free to believe that. He's a bad guy because he wants to kill everybody who disagrees with him. That's what makes him intolerant. But for people to say you Christians are wrong to believe that salvation is only through Jesus, they're only showing their intolerance. And they have the right to reject Jesus, just as we have the right to believe Jesus and to preach Jesus. And that's what tolerance is all about, freedom of religion.
That was one of the things that, like, you know, you look at the stuff that was going on in Egypt. I don't know if you saw, like, some of the pictures that are in some of the accounts is you would see Christians surrounding the Muslims to protect them while they prayed.
Yeah.
And then, conversely, you would see the Muslims surrounding the Christians to protect them while they prayed. Now, they totally disagreed with each other, but they were willing to both fight for their right to freely believe. And that is what tolerance is.
Yeah, and that's very rare in the Middle East. I was amazed.
I loved it. Oh, man, I was so moved when I saw that. I just got chills.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I hope that America is willing to fight for that type of tolerance and stuff.
Yeah.
All right, let's wrap it up here. Don, do you have any other questions or anything that you want to say?
No, I think you guys covered it.
Yeah, we're pretty good. Poor Don got stuck with two guys that don't ever stop talking.
Yeah, there were a few times I saw Don's hand going up, and I thought, and I just kept rambling on, so I apologize for that, Don, but
that's all right.
Okay, so hopefully we can jump back into this and keep doing this on a more regular basis, because I'm sure all of our fans out there are dying to hear it. So, till next time, we encourage you guys to defend the faith that was passed down once and for all by the faith. Seek the Lord, defend the faith, and God bless you guys.